This is a special feature produced for download from ABC Classic FM's website. Due to copyright restrictions on the music, it's been edited to make this possible.
Margaret Throsby with you on ABC Classic FM. How many islands do you think there are in Australian territory? 100? 200? Maybe 3? Not forgetting that a mainland Australia itself is an island, a very big one. Nevertheless, there are 700 islands, give or take, in Australia, from very small to large. Close to 10% of the world's population, that's 600 million people, live on islands today. Some at what we would think of as the far ends of the earth in harsh climates. Others, those mythical tropical paradises with swaying palm trees and warm sea lapping the sand, and every imaginable kind of island in between. The 10 Days on the Island Festival in Tasmania brings together island people from all over the world in a feast of art, performance, dance, theatre, storytelling, music. Today we're talking about islands with Professor Godfrey Baldacchino from the University of Prince Edward Island in Canada. Professor Baldacchino is originally from an old family in Malta, and music that he's chosen charts his journey from Malta to Prince Edward Island and closer to here with his interest in Tasmania. Village Festa from Malta Suite by Charles Camilleri, the New London Orchestra, and chosen by our guest today, Professor Godfrey Baldacchino. Good morning.
Good morning to you, Margaret.
Welcome to the program.
Thank you very much.
Tell me about that. Who was Charles Camilleri?
Well, Charles Camilleri, I think, is almost synonymous with Malta, the sounds of Malta, and the appreciation of Malta overseas. His music is very well respected, both in the region but also internationally. He was a professor at the University of Malta teaching music, but also an amateur astronomer, one of my my own hobbies. And of course, he is a way of, that allows me to introduce myself to your audience this morning, because he brings to mind, in a very poignant way, I must say, the emotions, the diversity, the brouhaha of Maltese culture. Very Mediterranean, very open, very vocal, very loud, but also, of course, a millenary culture. It's one that goes back many years and very, very respectful of its histories and its traditions.
Did you grow up very conscious of that? Do children in Malta, are they very imbued with the sense of the history of the place?
I'm not sure. I think I gathered a stronger appreciation of my own identity and my home the more I spent time away from home.
That's true. That's always the case, isn't it?
Probably.
Baldacchino doesn't strike me. It makes me think of an Italian name straight away. Is there
Baldacchino is much older than Italy, Margaret. Remember, Italy is an invention of 160 years.
That's true. Well, where does the name come from?
Baldacchino, I did some genealogical research. I think there's a region in Sicily, Ragusa region of Sicily, which has a fair amount of Baldacchinos there. So presumably one of my ancestors either escaped or decided to see greener pastures moving south to the next island, which would be Malta. There are Baldacchinos listed on an old militia list going back to the 15th century. But going back further, the name Baldac is the Roman word for Baghdad. So possibly there may also be links with the Middle East.
Very interesting. What are your memories of your young childhood in Malta? What was life like?
Very cosmopolitan, very hectic. Malta is a very, very small island. It's only 12 miles long and 8 miles wide.
Is it densely populated?
It's very, very densely populated.
Is there any countryside for lambs and sheep
and
things?
There is actually what we would call countryside. And it's now the lung of the country and the way in which most people go to, you know, recreate themselves, enjoy their leisure time, and try to protect whatever is left.
Where did your family go for holidays?
We actually preferred going to the sister island of Malta, which is Gozo, which is 5 miles away from the main island. It's even smaller than Malta. It's 8 miles by 6.
Mm.
30,000 people live there. 370,000 live on the main island.
Tell me about your parents.
My parents. My father, who unfortunately has passed on, used to work at the dockyard as a technician, an electrical fitter as well. My mother, still alive, God bless her, she spent all her life, in fact, she still is part-time, even though she's 80, working as a teacher, elementary school teacher.
She still teaches?
She still teaches, you know, as a volunteer with mainly adults. And she reads avidly. I mean, the things that she asks me when I visit is to bring her a book in French that she can read.
It's not a coincidence then that her son is a teacher, an academic teacher, university teacher.
Perhaps, yeah. I spent most of my life living as my mother's son. Now she is finding herself being looked at as her son's mother.
Tell us about school. Were you a good student at school?
Well, I got my grades, but
were you
in the
well
process,
behaved, Godfrey? I've heard stories.
No, I don't think so. I think I had the reputation for being a bit, you know, naughty and mischievous. I was suspended from school a few times. I shouldn't let my son know that. I hope he's not listening to this program. But well, I mean, it's part probably of the way in which the anxiety that I feel about structure and authority and this questioning attitude that I have, you know, that doesn't want to stay at rest.
What ambitions did you nurse as a child about what you might do with your life? Did you see yourself spending all your life in Malta? I mean, I just wondered whether there was a sense, I want to go and see the world. I want to, you know, see bigger...
I think so. Increasingly feeling logged in, and that the opportunity to flex my muscles were being inhibited by perhaps, you know, vested interests, conservatism, the inability perhaps to strike out and being respected for being innovative, because people usually who try to do that, they suffer from the tall poppy syndrome. You know, lots of people will be envious or want to just get them in line. And many Maltese actually do that. There are probably more Maltese living out of Malta these days, including Australia, as you know, than on Malta itself. Of course, some of them go back, and I do visit. I do maintain a visiting professorship at the University of Malta. I teach there every year. My elder son lives there. I still have a house. My mother is still there. So it's like living in two different worlds right now.
So the degree you took at the University of Malta was in what?
It was a general degree in English and Social Studies. I still had no idea what I wanted to do with myself. I was originally thinking that perhaps I could start off as a teacher, and I did. But then I was given a part-time position at the university, and I developed that into a full-time job. And following my doctorate, I applied and got a full-time position at the University of Malta. That position, by the way, was in sociology. But I also have a strong interest in labor relations. So much of my research has to do with trade unions, employer organizations, entrepreneurship, economic development.
Mm-hmm. Can you remember at what age you began to think of islands? Because when I said to people, when they said, who are you talking to on Thursday, I told them about you. People say, I've never thought about islands particularly. I mean, if you say to people islands, they think Pacific islands with palm trees. But
yeah.
Can you remember when you started consciously to have a feeling that islands needed studying?
That's a very good question. And I can actually trace that moment almost exactly to a particular day. It was 1990, around August, I think. I had submitted an application to start a doctoral thesis, a PhD research at a university in the UK. And my application was rejected. And I was told that I had basically 24 hours left to decide whether I want to resubmit or wait for the next term, which would be in a year's time.
Was your topic labor relations or something like that?
It was about labor relations, but it was fairly staid, fairly, you know, uncompromising, unchallenging. And the professor told me, you know, this is not interesting enough. You won't survive for 3 years trying to investigate what is probably already a dead topic. So, oh my God, I said, what am I going to do? And that's where my guard went down, and I decided to be spontaneous. And overnight, I submitted a new proposal which was about trying to explore the connectivity between smallness and islandness in relation to labour relations.
What gave you the thought?
I don't know. It was a gut reaction. It was completely spontaneous. So I let my right brain, in a way, take control of over my left brain for a change.
So at some level, you must have been thinking about the phenomenon of being an island person.
I think so, yes. I mean, Malta is an island, of course. It's there, but we don't usually think of ourselves as islanders. And the reason for that probably is because we are also a country. And it's as if looking at yourself as an island diminishes yourself, you know? Once you are an island, it seems that you then become the object of something else, the object of the gaze of the mainland, the object of the projects of someone else. So we Maltese are very proud of being an independent nation, and of course, I think that's a respectable position.
Yes, that's interesting.
Unfortunately,
because
we exclude the richness of associating that and that and adding to that the added baggage of being an island as well.
Yes. Very interesting. I think we'll take some more music. And
all right.
That we started in Malta with that Camilleri piece. This is Stompin' Tom Connors with Bud the Spud. Now tell me what this is.
Well, this is a transition now from the Mediterranean to the North Atlantic, to my new home. I've been living in Canada since 2003 with my wife and my younger son.
On an island.
Indeed, on Prince Edward Island. Prince Edward Island is the only fully islanded province of Canada. So in that respect, it has very, very similar situation to Tasmania in relation to Australia.
The spuds are big on the back of Bud's rig. They're from Prince Edward Island. They're from Prince Edward Island. Now I know a lot of people from east to west that like the spuds from the island best, cause they'll stand up to the hardest test right on the table. So when you see that big truck rolling by, wave your hand or kind of wink your eye, cause that's Bud the Spud from old PEI with another big load of potatoes. It's Bud the Spud from the bright red mud rolling down the highway smiling, because he's got another big load of the best doggone potatoes that's ever been growed. And they're from Prince Edward Island. They're from Prince Edward Island.
That's Stompin' Tom Connors and Bud the Spud from, and he's from Prince Edward Island. Is Prince Edward Island famous for its spuds?
Indeed it is.
As is Tasmania.
Exactly.
Yeah, interesting.
Yeah, another connection.
Another connection.
And being from Prince Edward Island, Tom Connors would call himself an islander. And that's something that strikes right at the heart of the identity of people who live on Prince Edward Island, right? So all the time they are reminding themselves that they are islanders.
I'm an islander, I'm not a mainlander.
Exactly.
Do they refer to the mainlanders as mainlanders?
Yeah. They do, or they just refer to it as away, you know, it's somewhere away.
Yes,
people who come from away are not islanders.
Why do we study islands, Godfrey?
I think we have an obligation to, in a way, connect with the world and the different places of the world, and some of these places mark themselves out for us. There's this thing about island and water, right? We look at water as an obstacle, as a barrier, and therefore something that is cut out by water presents itself as distinct. Now, of course, we know that islands, even though they appear to be surrounded by water, they're actually connected via the seabed to the mainland, right, in most cases. But yet, the sense of separation, the sense of uniqueness, serves as the platform, as a basis for a whole gamut of ideas, of projects, of emotions that surround island life.
Are island people different, do you think, from mainland people?
That's a question that will continue to be raised by many. Some people think that they are different.
Does it depend on the size of the island? I'm just thinking, if you have a small island, then you could have what could be called an islander mentality.
Yeah.
If you have a big island, and Australia is defined as an island. I mean, I don't think people in Australia, on the mainland, particularly think of themselves as living on an island. Although, it has to be said, there is that mentality also that we're surrounded by water, therefore we're, you know.
Yeah, the interesting thing about these perceptions is that they can change. You may feel yourself on a continent one day, and very pleased with you and comfortable that you're at the center of the universe and you can dictate matters to whoever and so on. But suddenly, say, in relation to potential immigrants, you may feel that you're an island, you're threatened. you're liable to be invaded. You're liable to have your quote-unquote authenticity tweaked and infected by external inputs. And that's the nature of island life. Island life is very much about the impact of what's going to come across the horizon, what's going to come up in our life tomorrow.
Mm.
Islands are vulnerable to rapid change.
Yes, and there are very different kinds of settings or situations on islands. You can have an island like Prince Edward Island or Tasmania, which have relatively large populations compared with other islands.
Yep.
And other islands are seen as holiday destinations, places to go to simplify your life and to wind down. So you're talking about the gamut, are you, the whole
yes.
lot?
Yes, there is this neat division that you've very rightly pointed out, Margaret. There are islands, of course, that have their own local citizens and residents, and I am sure that they do not see themselves as being tourists or of just having fun. Their island is not just a Coney Island, it's not just a holiday place. But then from a mainland point of view, many mainlanders only see themselves as affording connecting with islands for a short time, in which case they usually play the tourist.
Mm.
And of course, tourism is all about having a great experience. So we attribute the places that we want to visit with the imaginations that we would like fulfilled.
Islands are said to have pioneered the emergence of disciplines like biogeography and anthropology. Is that true?
Yes, I think it is true.
Explain what you mean, what we mean by that.
Tasmania, of course, was on the route of Charles Darwin when he went on his famous journey around the world. And Charles Darwin, primarily from his observations from islands, especially from the Galapagos Islands, which I think he visited before coming to Hobart, he came up on the theory of evolution, which basically explains how nature allows itself to change in relation to adaptation to environmental change, and how island spaces, because they are cut off, because they have living things that are, that are separated from their mainland counterparts by distance and from significant amount of time. They tend to evolve in different ways. Indeed, they can even evolve to the extent of becoming endemic species. So they become distinct species in their own terms. And therefore, some people actually make the jump, as you did earlier. They build the connection between the biogeography and the human or the culture. Does it mean that just because we have endemic species on islands, like the Tasmanian devil, right? Mm-hmm. We also have an endemic human species in Tasmania? And that's, I think, that's an unfair comparison, because unlike animal species or flora, people move. People are mobile beings, mm-hmm. and therefore they maintain themselves through a circulation of experiences, which include the island, but which also include other spaces.
But presumably there's a vulnerability for human island populations if a disease is introduced, for instance. The sea becomes the barrier to escape, from escape, doesn't it?
Yes, correct. The sea, the sea is a barrier that can prevent diseases from arriving on islands, or that can prevent invaders from landing on islands, and then, of course, having their own effects. But once there is the connection, once the disease, once the idea arrives on an island, its effect is usually total, rapid, and sudden. And there's no escape, or very little escape. In which case, then, people have to think about sometimes, packing their bags and moving somewhere else.
When you're studying islands, and I know you've done this for a long time now and you teach about it, are you constantly at pains to define what you're talking about? Because if we talk about an island like Prince Edward Island or Tasmania,
yeah.
we're not talking about an island like the islands of Fiji or Indonesia, are we?
Yeah.
They're all very different, but I just wonder, what are the common threads that unite them?
Let's start with the last two you mentioned, Margaret. You mentioned Fiji and Indonesia, for example. There are two states, countries, but they're also archipelagos. And one of the interesting features of the study of islands is how does the archipelago affect the way that the places run, right? So both Fiji and Indonesia have large concentrations of populations, as well as most of the government infrastructure, on one particular island. So the rest of the archipelago is on the periphery of its own country. And that's one of the challenges of running an archipelagic country.
So it's like a little mainland surrounded by islands.
You could say that, or even a little continent if you wish, right?
Mm. So you'd say Java in this instance.
Java and Viti Levu, right?
Yeah.
The main island in Fiji.
Yes.
So you will have these effects, and you'll have to somehow, if you're trying to run this space, you have to somehow, you know, manage the interests of the periphery, the small community on that small island, which also want to have their own hospital, their own school, their own community hall, their own swimming pool, with the interests of the majority, which might perhaps benefit from economies of scale. This is one of the challenges of island governance.
Has the study of islands taken off in this era of globalization?
It's interesting that you put the two things together. I think that, yes, there is an interesting relationship between the presumed threat of sameness that results from globalization. Some people may celebrate sameness. It's great that we can speak the same language, even though we come from different countries. We are using a technology that's basically standard. You know, a radio station is a radio station. The format is also fairly standard. We go through spaces that are almost chock-a-block, cut off from a template and applied across the world. Think of a university, think of an airport, think of a railway station, think of a port. And this is good. This is good from a mobility point of view. It's great. It facilitates communication and interaction. But at the same time, it's a threat. And if you have a particular culture, a particular language, a particular way of doing things that you think has value because it has meaning to you, then perhaps you may want to think about whether you just wanted to go with the flow or whether it's worth keeping, worth proclaiming, worth acknowledging in the first place. And I think that much of what island studies actually does is precisely this. It's accentuating the role of place in an age of space. It's accentuating the role of locality, of identity, of who we are in the places that make us who we are, in relation to a time-space compression that's wonderful, but has threats associated with it.
Yeah. And there are stories from all over the world, from your country, this country, Europe, all across the island, where there are islands, of attempts by authorities of one kind or another, governments or whoever, to connect islands back to the mainland by bridges.
Indeed.
I was reading about one last night in Iran. I mean, in Iran, of all places, I wouldn't have thought. But there's been a dispute there about
really?
Connecting an island, yes, to mainland. Australia's littered with examples.
Yeah.
And I presume you're part of the world in Prince Edward Island too, isn't it?
Yes, and that's been a very contentious decision on Prince Edward Island.
It seems to me that a lot of people who have a romantic notion of islands or the islanders themselves
yeah.
are the ones who are mostly not keen for a bridge to be built. Is that fair enough?
I think it is a fair comment. Most of the people who... Well, let me qualify that. Most of the people who are apprehensive of fixed links, whether they are bridges, causeways, or tunnels, are those who celebrate what they call the island way of life. They know that it's different, that they know that there's a different understanding of time and space and the way that we relate to each other and the sense of community and so on. And of course, those are sometimes the very same reasons why people want islands to be connected.
Mm.
So you have this division, sometimes within the same community. Those who come from somewhere else to visit the island, for example, people who have second homes, I think you call them shacks, and in the context of Tasmania, those people are probably even stronger against, much more aggressively against anything resembling a fixed link. Just think of Bruny Island, you know, down the coast from Hobart.
Perfect example.
I think it's a good example, and I know people who live there full time, and of course they wouldn't dream of having a fixed link. The ferry is bad enough or good enough, depending how you look at it.
Mm.
They will need, of course, to have a connection. But at the same time, it is that precise, that technological infrastructure, or rather its absence, that allows that island to determine its own identity. And it's not just a suburb of Hobart, as we know.
Yes. I'm just trying to think who was the success. Why did it succeed, the channel, the connection between Britain and the continent? Why did that succeed? Was it purely on tourist and trade grounds that it
How
succeeded?
Do you define success?
Well, it succeeded in being built. Because there was a lot of discussion about it for a long
while.
That's
not the issue, really. I mean, if you want something to be built and the government is behind it, it's probably
built.
Be able to leverage the financing, even though the Channel Tunnel has been doing losses, actually. So not good news for the investors. But Britain is a very large island. And the larger you are, Britain is slightly larger than Tasmania, by the way, just for the sake of perspective. But the larger you are and the larger the population, the greater the need probably to be connected, even in a material way. So you can less afford to be an islander on a relatively large island. And I hope I'll be able to bring this up later on when we talk about Tasmania, because Tasmania's size, in a way, makes it a bit too large, perhaps, for it to see itself as an island.
Yes. Do you find people here, because you've been here for a few weeks now, yeah, and I know you've been here several times, do you find people here don't think of themselves as living on an island? I mean, they think of themselves as very separate from the mainland, don't
yes,
they?
Yes, exactly. Yes, yes, they do. There's this angst, there's this feeling of ambivalence in relation to the mainland.
And yet a lot of people on the mainland are saying, I'd love to move to Tasmania, you see.
Well, I'm not sure about that. I don't know how many would be interested in doing that.
I think more and more,
right,
actually.
That's
I think
a good
more
thing.
And more. Okay, let's talk about this. This is Christine Arnoux. We're talking right very relevantly here. This is called Island Home. Why? Tell me about this.
Christine Arnoux strikes me as a person who is proclaiming the in-betweenity of island spaces.
The in-betweenity.
Yeah, it's a term that I like using.
Yeah.
It reminds us that islands are not just fixed, you know, out on a periphery, on an edge. They are edgy, but in a positive sense as well. They are anxious spaces. They are spaces that allow us to think differently. And Christine Arnoux represents that space. She is, in a way, herself an island. She is an island straddling her Torres Strait identity with her Australian identity. And, of course, this particular song, Island Home, also represents not just the Australian identity and Australian pride, but the way in which Australia connected very nicely in hosting the Sydney Olympic Games.
My island home, my island home, my island home is waiting for me. My island home, my island home, my island home is waiting for me.
Christine Arnoux and My Island Home, chosen by our guest today, Professor Godfrey Baldacchino, a visitor from King Edward Island. I'd like to come to King Edward in just a moment.
It's
but
Prince.
Well, sorry, sorry?
It's Prince Edward Island, not Prince, King.
Sorry, oh, sorry, Prince Edward Island.
King Island is a different island, Margaret.
Yes, indeed. It is indeed. It's much closer to here.
It is.
Islands figure in literature a lot, don't they?
Yes,
does that
do.
Come into the teaching that you do about islands?
It certainly does.
Because when I started thinking about it, I mean, from Treasure Island to John Donne, to all sorts of islands.
Yeah, in a way, the grappling with the island is probably oldest in literature. I mean, if you go back, say, even to the Odyssey, right? It's a journey of a nomad visiting different islands and eventually returning back to his island home, as Christine Arnoux very, very nicely reminds us. Literature is very much gripped by this almost an obsession to travel to islands and then do something to them or with them. And, of course, this kind of obsession has ridden parallel in history with the colonial tradition. So it's almost an imperialist project, you know. And sometimes we couch the debate on climate change in almost the same way. You know, we have an obligation to save the planet, and we adopt that kind of a technical solution to the problem. We look at the planet as an Earth island, indeed. And once we do that, we tend to look at ourselves as engineers and try to fix the situation.
That's
of course,
that's the astronomer in you talking, isn't it?
Perhaps. That's the scientist in me, too. I'm not sure whether that kind of approach actually works, because that renders the island as merely the object of our implements and the object of our tools and our input. It reduces the role of nature as itself a kind of a balancing mechanism which has its own inner dynamics and so on, which perhaps we need to respect a bit more. So, yes, literature for sure is a way in which we remind ourselves also that islands are not just physical spaces. They don't just exist in time and place. They're also metaphysical. They're places that we can engage with them in order to represent perhaps deeper, darker truths.
Have you studied specific island communities?
I've done a lot of research on Prince Edward Island itself. Prince Edward Island is, as you said, a small province, 140,000 people.
See, it's not a very large, but what sort of land area is it? Is it big?
It's about 5,000 square kilometers, I believe. So it's much, much smaller than Tasmania.
So to drive from one end to the other would take?
2.5 hours, I think, 3 hours maximum. Mm-hmm. It's relatively long from tip to tip, but narrow. So it's, you know, the length it takes to cross from one end to the other disguises its real size, which is
Does it have
smaller.
A long history? Has it been inhabited for a long time?
Again, we have to be careful how do we interpret history. We have Aboriginal people on Prince Edward Island. We call them First Nations. As far as they are concerned, they have been there forever. They have been there for tens of thousands of years. The island has its own indigenous name, indigenous history. Of course, much of that history is not written, unfortunately. But it would be a mistake to associate history with the arrival of, you know, European settlers. The island has had a major role in the determination of the Canadian nation, the Canadian identity as a state. It was the birthplace, so-called birthplace of Confederation. One fairly important conference was held there in 1864, trying to consider the whole idea of linking together the Canadian provinces.
And so that's recognized, is it?
Yes, it is recognized, of course. Charlottetown, which is the provincial capital, is so-called cradle of Confederation in the Canadian context. And the most recent research I've carried out in relation to Prince Edward Island has to do with the recent influx of immigrants coming in from Asia, wanting to settle in Canada, but not necessarily on PEI itself. And therefore, the challenges of trying to encourage these people to actually settle on the island rather than get them in and then see them move away.
So you mean they're arriving in Canada as migrants of
some kind?
They're
using Prince Edward Island as their port of entry. Right, so the province becomes their host province,
and you don't want them to escape. You want them
the province needs population. At least that is the political rhetoric that we hear. Labor market needs skilled employees. It needs entrepreneurs. It needs investors, and of course, many of these are now coming as immigrants. And the difficulties arise in trying to ensure that these people actually stay there once they arrive.
What do the young people of Prince Edward Island do? Are they all bent on getting out of there as quickly as possible and going somewhere else? Or
that's a good question, and perhaps that's something that connects with youth all over the place. You don't have to be an islander, but perhaps especially if you are an islander, you may want to explore the world. From my interactions with students at the University of Prince Edward Island, so we're talking about people, say, 18 to 20 years of age, many of them start off with a kind of a, you know, cabin fever attitude. You know, I want to leave. This place is too small for me. I want to see the world, which is great. I think it's a good idea. But it would be even greater for their island if they managed to get back and perhaps contribute to the prosperity, to the cultural vibrancy, to the locality of their island space by bringing back networks, ideas, connections, relations that they would have obtained in the metropole.
What happens on Prince Edward Island? Is there farming? Is there industry? Is there technology? What are the things that happen there?
Again, very similar to Tasmania. It's primarily a resource-based, agricultural-related industry.
Is it beautiful physically?
It's very beautiful, especially in summer.
Very cold in winter?
Unfortunately for me, yes.
Very deep snow.
You know, I come from the Mediterranean, so it takes some time to get used to that, even after 8 years there. It has four seasons, you know. And, of course, the harshness of the winter explains then why it's so beautiful in summer. Mm. These things depend on each other.
Mm.
The fall is also especially nice. The fall season, when literally, you know, the place turns red and brown, all shades of amber.
Is tourism big?
Tourism is increasingly important. Probably the most famous character associated with Prince Edward Island is Anne of Green Gables. Again, connection.
Was that set on Prince Edward Island?
Indeed, it is.
That was one
so
of my
Lucy Maud Montgomery
books.
Is probably the most famous islander, right?
Yeah.
And this again explains the connection with island literature. So we have this whole landscape. And the way in which this landscape has been transmitted to young girls in many parts of the world and struck a chord with their adolescent tensions and crises, right? And that, in a way, also explains much of the interest in Prince Edward Island as a tourism destination.
Very interesting. All right, music, please. Now, this is a thing called Song for the Fallen Wilderness, and I think this brings us right back to Tasmania, doesn't
it? Yes, it does.
Here it is. Carey Leeuwenkamp and Song for the Fallen Wilderness. And I'm talking this morning to Godfrey Baldacchino. We've been talking about islands and island study. The Fallen Wilderness, have you seen much of Tasmania on this visit to this part of the world?
I've been to a few parts of Tasmania, but I have not been to the wilderness, which in a way obliges me to return at some point in time.
Mm.
The reason for choosing the song, Margaret, to me, is very much about my, in a way, my recollection of my Tasmanian experience. I've been here for a few weeks, so I think I've been, in a way, long enough to come up with a more mature appreciation than just a kind of a touristic understanding of the place. Much of what I sense about the Tasmanian identity has very much to do with what to do with trees.
What to do with trees?
What to do with trees. There was an article in The Economist last month about Tasmania, and the image, the photo that accompanied the article was about trees. There were trees in this image. And, I mean, Tasmania, in a way, needs to understand itself better, perhaps appreciate itself more as an island space. It's not just a reproduction of the mainland. I don't think the mandate of Tasmania is to be a little Australia, even from an economic point of view.
Do you think Tasmania sees itself like that?
I'm not sure. That's one of the reasons why I'm posing this question to your audience. It certainly sees its offshore islands as somewhat special places that perhaps deserve being looked at as different, and therefore as places where nature is seen in a different way, where time and space and energy are conceived differently. But as far as Tasmania is concerned, because it has a mainland, a large mainland, and the heartland, and such an important agriculture and resource-based industry, it perhaps finds it difficult to wean itself away from a resource-based, exploitative industrial model of development that sees size as important, big is beautiful, transforming natural products into commodities, sometimes with very limited value added. I mean, there is an attempt to brand Tasmania in a certain way, but heavy industry does not fit into the brand. And a brand can be good, it can be consistent, but once there is something that strikes you as inconsistent with the brand, it juts out like a sore thumb. And this is my feeling of extractive industry in Tasmania. I think it's time to, you know, kind of take in the implications of branding Tasmania as a clean, green, pristine location with the purest air in the world, with the most fertile soil in the world, right?
Yes.
These are things that I think we need to really privilege.
The air's like champagne in this part of the world.
It's good to hear you say that.
Yeah. Are there similarities with Prince Edward Island?
In a way, yes. We also have our own concerns about the environment. There are debates about whether we should go completely organic, for example, whether we should eliminate genetically modified crops, whether we should, as much as possible, encourage value added from agricultural mm-hmm. products, right? And we are taking that in some cases in mm-hmm. the same directions that you are here.
Yeah.
Wine, good food, gourmet food for export markets, of course, high value added and privileged potatoes, oysters, mussels, very well branded.
Fish.
I think we're heading in the same direction, but we need to have this kind of comfort zone with nature.
Well, you've given us a lot to think about. Thank you so much for that. It was a very interesting conversation.
My pleasure.
Your final piece is Bob Marley. Tell us what we're hearing and why.
Right. I thought that it would be useful to get back to a more global stage. We go to the Caribbean, the most heavily hyped island region in the world, the festival playground of many, many millions of people. But at the same time, it's also a place that has struck back. It's a place that has its own cultural industries. Reggae is a global industry. Bob Marley is an icon. And it's good to remind ourselves that islands are spaces that can actually invade mainlands too.
Jumping, 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 j
That's Bob Marley and the song called Jammin', and it was the final choice of our guest today, Professor Godfrey Baldacchino, Canada Research Chair in Island Studies and Associate Professor in the Department of Sociology and Anthropology at the University of Prince Edward Island in Canada. Tomorrow, Patsy Cameron, Aboriginal Elder, Tasmanian Aboriginal Historian at the University of Tasmania. She's been researching the journals of George Augustus Robinson in the early 1800s in Tassie, and we'll meet Patsy Cameron tomorrow. Damien is next with Just Classics. It's time for the news at 11.
This feature was produced by ABC Classic FM. You'll find more audio of our programs, along with special features for download, on our website at abc.net.au/classic/audio.